Okay. My name is Agnes Ugoji, and I am currently in my home in Boston, Massachusetts, and I'm doing a Zoom interview with William Bill McCurran, who is currently in San Diego, California. Today is October 29th, 2021, and the time is 4:21 p.m. Eastern Time. This interview is for the Dartmouth Black Lives Oral History Project. Hello, Bill. Can I call you Bill?
Absolutely. Hello, Agnes.
Thank you for joining me today. First, I'd like to learn a little bit about your background. Can you tell me a bit about your childhood? When and where were you born?
I was born in 1947 in Chicago, Illinois, to William McCurran Jr., a senior, and my mother, Dorothy Marie Jones. And that, of course, when she got married, her surname changed. And I had just about an idyllic childhood. I mean, every childhood has problems. My mother and father were divorced when I was 3 years old, but I was surrounded by a loving extended family. So I just had a wonderful childhood.
Oh, it's wonderful to hear. What did your parents do for a living?
My dad was an executive with what was then called the Chicago Housing Authority. And my mother was the head of the key punch unit for the Railroad Retirement Board. Did you by any chance see the movie Hidden Figures?
Yes.
Okay, those women were key punch operators.
Oh.
And so my mother was the head of the entire key punch unit for the entire railroad retirement system. And she was the first Black to ever take that position. She was extremely good with numbers. She loved math, and she excelled in her position.
Oh, that's wonderful. Did you have any siblings growing up?
Well, My father was married to a beautiful woman before he met my mother, and he had two daughters from that marriage. My mother was his second marriage, and I was the only child from that union. And then my father married a third time, and there was a son from that union.
So did you all grow up in the same house?
Oh, no, no.
No?
I knew my older half-sisters, but not well. And I knew my half-brother fairly well until I went away to college. But we never lived in the same house together.
So essentially you lived as an only child for most of your childhood.
Correct.
And what was that like?
Well, I loved it. Although I was an only child, my extended family was very close. So my maternal grandmother, whom we all called Big Mama, and Big Mama was maybe 4 feet 11, and she may have weighed 110 pounds maybe, and she was quiet. But I think it was just the force of her character that people called her Big Mama. So Big Mama owned a large tenement building on the west side of Chicago, and it had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 apartments. And of those 6 apartments, 5 were her children or relatives. So I was surrounded by cousins as I grew up. So I was an only child, but I was immersed in a family culture with children my own age. So I never had the, sometimes people say only children get lonely. I never felt that. And it does partly explain the fact that my wife calls me a gregarious loner. I love being alone and I love being with people. So I can go to a movie by myself, I can go to dinner by myself, have a wonderful time. and I can go to movies with people and go to dinner with people and have a wonderful time.
Well, that's great to hear. Oh, that's very interesting. So did your family always reside in Chicago?
Yeah, the core of the family, they came from Stanton, Tennessee, which when they immigrated from Stanton, it had a population of 4,000. I think today, Stanton still has a population of 4,000. And I traveled to Tennessee once, but all my time growing up, I was basically in Chicago, and all the family that I knew well was in Chicago.
Okay. And what was it like? Did you grow up in the West Side of Chicago, correct?
Yes. Well, for the first 8 years, it was the West Side. And then after that, my mother married Robert Patterson, and they moved to the South Side of Chicago near 35th and Cottage Grove.
Okay. And quick, going back one question, what was Big Mama's name?
Anna Jones. Anna Lou Jones.
Anna Lou Jones. Thank you. So where'd you go to high school?
Well, for the first year, I went to Wendell Phillips on the South Side of Chicago. And then for my sophomore through senior grades, I went to the Francis Parker School on the North Side of Chicago.
So what are, I'm not from Chicago, so do you, could you like help me know the difference between the West Side and the North Side?
Well, at that time, Chicago was very racially divided, and Blacks lived south or west, and near west, not far west. Far west, far south, and north were whites. The North Side was affluent, but the far west and the far south would be Eastern European groups, Western European groups like Italians, and the black people pretty much congregated on the South Side, near South Side, and the near West Side.
Okay, thank you. So what, you went to two different high schools during your time. What led you to moving from Wendell Phillips to the other one?
Parental sabotage. My family's always stressed education. I'd always done very well in school. And my freshman year, I went to Wendell Phillips. And I made the honor roll on the first marking period. And my friends warned me that people would think I was a sissy if I made the honor roll, and I would be fighting all the time. And I said, oh, well, I don't want to do that. So I purposely set out to fail all my classes or just barely get by, except for one. The English class was headed by Dr. Donald H. Smith, who was a very progressive Black educator with a PhD in education, who devoted himself to improving the educational opportunities for young Black people. He had worked out a plan with the principal of Wendell Phillips that would allow him to handpick 40 to 50 students, and they would all be in his English class. And he pushed us to excel and made it very clear to us that we must excel everywhere, but particularly in his class. And he was remarkable. He was both inspired and inspiring. I don't know how he did it, but he was able to get prominent Black people to come to our class to speak. So for example, he had Jackie Robinson come. He had Gwendolyn Brooks, who was a famous Black poet and she read her poetry. And those sessions opened my eyes to the possibilities, because at that time, a good career for a Black person was to be a postal worker, to get a city government job if you could. And really, that was pretty much it. The idea of being a doctor, a lawyer, that was just not part of our thought. But with Dr. Smith, he provoked us to imagine greater things. And when he found out halfway through my first year that I was flunking my other classes, he was shocked. And he secretly had my mother come to school. My mother had been asking for my report card, and I had been repeatedly lying, telling her that there was something wrong with the system and they hadn't published the grades yet. So I was called to the principal's office one day, and there were the principal, Dr. Smith, and my mother, and her eyes were flaming red. She was so angry with me, and rightly so. Well, unbeknownst to me, they arranged for me to take an entrance exam at the Francis Parker School on the north side of Chicago, and they did it surreptitiously. So one morning I woke up and my mom said, your dad is coming to pick you up at 7 o'clock. You better get dressed. I said, why is Pops coming to pick me up? She said, I don't know. You have to ask him. They were being secretive because I had told them that if they ever tried to put me in a white school, I would run away. So they didn't tell me. And so I got in the car with my father and I said, well, Pops, where are we going? He didn't speak a word. He didn't say a single, he didn't say hello. He didn't say wait and see. He was silent. So I thought he didn't hear me. I repeated the question again, cold silence. So I got quiet and we started driving north. And at that time, there was a clear dividing line between North and South Chicago, and it was downtown at Randolph. And we crossed Randolph Street. That means we're going into the wealthy white neighborhood. I said, Dad, where are we going? He didn't say anything. And then he eventually pulled over to a curb. He looked at me and he said, get out. I said, what? He said, get out. So I got out of the car and he drove away. I had no idea what was going on, and I was wondering, well, are they going to leave me on the streets? What's going on? And this young white girl named Lori Negronida was skipping down the sidewalk, and she said, hi, are you Billy McCurran? I said, well, yeah. I'm wondering, how does she know me? I said, who are you? She said, I'm Lori Negronida, your hostess. I said, where am I? She said, you don't know where you are? I said, no. She said, you're at the Francis Parker School. I said, well, why am I here? She said, you don't know why you're here? I said, no. She said, you're here to take the entrance exam. And so for the next 5 hours, I took entrance exams. And 3 weeks later, I was at the school. School started. So when I went there, it was like early August. And football coach, Coach McBride, heard I was coming and he recruited me for the football team. And that integrated me into the school. It was the best decision my parents ever could have made for my education. And I did well at Francis Parker and loved it. It was difficult in a variety of levels, but it was an amazing experience.
Oh, wow. And what year did you get admittance into Francis Parker?
I think it's 1962.
Okay, and then what year did you graduate?
1965.
1964. Thank you. That is so interesting. So apart from football, did you do anything else at in high school?
Well, I played basketball, football. I was head of the social events committee, and it was a small school. The high school, Francis Parker was based on the educational principles of an educator named Francis Parker. And he was a progressive educator. And so he believed that all the grades should be integrated. So the school went from junior kindergarten all the way up to the 12th grade. And everybody who was grades 5 through 8 had a younger person in the lower grades for whom they served as a big brother or big sister. And everybody in the high school had somebody in the 5th, 6th, 7th grade and lower. You always had at least two people, one in the real elementary school and one in what might be called the junior high school. And so the school deliberately created a family atmosphere, and I thrived there.
Oh wow. And was it a boarding school or did you commit
Oh
come
no, I commuted. I commuted, which meant that my school day was very long. So in order to get there, my mother and I did not own a car, so she worked out that a guy would give us a ride to the near north side, right near the Miracle Mile in Chicago. My mother worked very closely what is called the Miracle Mile, and then I would take an elevated train and then a bus to get to school. And then after school, I would take bus, train, bus to get home.
by yourself?
Oh yeah.
Oh,
My
wow.
mother believed in making me independent. And so she taught me how to, the L train, it's called the L, which is an abbreviation for elevated train. And so it was generally 30 feet above ground. And that was part of it. When it went through downtown, it was a subway, but it would come up out of the subway and just go to the elevated tracks. Well, when I was, oh, maybe 8 years old, she said, okay, you're gonna learn how to go downtown on your own. So we would take the bus. She said, this is the bus you take. What's the number? Write it down. And then, okay, we're gonna take the elevated train, and you're always going to go north to get downtown, and you're gonna go south to get home. So all the trains that stopped at that particular station went downtown, all the northbound trains, and all stopped, had the same stops downtown. So she would say, okay, go down. We're gonna walk around, do a little shopping, and then we'll go back. And then next week, you're gonna have to do it on your
Oh,
own. And when Big Mama found out that I was taking a bus and the L to go downtown by myself, she was furious with my mother. And she and Big Mama and my mother were as close as a mother and daughter can be. They just loved each other. But she was furious at that until she saw that I could do it. She said, Billy, weren't you scared? I said, well, no, I knew how to do it. So from 8 years old, if I wanted to go downtown, I just get on the bus, take it to the L, and reverse that process to come home.
so it wasn't scary to, do the long commute from high school because you've been doing
Oh
it
no, I was so used. Well, we didn't own a car, so if we wanted to get around, you had to take public transportation. And the public transportation system in Chicago is excellent. You can go anywhere in Chicago on public transportation, and it wasn't expensive. When my mother married Bob Patterson, he had a car, but I think I drove it once. If I wanted to go somewhere, it was the bus or the L. Mm-hmm. So that was just a way of life. But that was true for almost all Black people, almost all people in general.
Yeah. And I have a question. On your previous high school, is it Wendell Phillips or Window Phillips?
W-E-N-D-E-L-L.
Okay, thank you. So with the stress of education that came from your family and also from the school that you went to, did you have any idea of what you want to do after high school? And also, what made you pursue higher education?
Well, from the moment I was little, my mother and father told me I was going to college. Now, I didn't know how that was going to happen, but that was not a decision to make. It was a decision that had been made. My decision was which college to go to. And then once I got to Francis Parker, which is a college preparatory school, everybody, you know, going to college was the natural, indeed the inevitable next step. So they just fit right in with my family culture. And I just always thought that once I got to Francis Parker, I'm going to college.
And did your parents go to college?
My mother only went to, she finished high school. She actually graduated as a valedictorian of her high school. It was integrated at that time, believe it or not. But because she was Black and a woman, they wouldn't give it to her. They gave it to the number two, who was a friend of my mother, an Italian man. But that's just the way it was in those days. My dad, I think, had a couple of years at Morehouse College. He may have even graduated from Morehouse College. I know very little about his actual background. I know he did go to Morse College. Morse College. But I don't know if he graduated.
So did you say Morris or Morehouse?
I meant Morehouse.
Okay, so I did some research on you, and I found out that you were a part of the ABC program, or the program. Can you tell me a little bit about how you got involved in that?
Well, so my freshman year at Dartmouth was 1965, mm-hmm. and the ABC program already existed as in what we call private schools. So ABC, which means a better chance, would recruit second tier Black students. They wouldn't pick the very best, because the theory was they would be able to go into college anyway. They picked that next group that would be able to go to college if they got an extra push. And so the private arm of ABC would recruit students to go to prestigious private schools in New England. So Phillips Academy at Exeter, Phillips Academy at Andover, Choate, you name it. But it's very expensive because they had to pay the regular tuition. And then Thomas McCullough and Dean Dye, D-E-Y, came up with the idea of running an ABC program in communities that had a very good public school, because then you don't have to face tuition and housing the students in one house, providing tutors, and then they would go to the local high school. So I was active in African American affairs on the campus. And over the summer, Dean Dye, he was dean of what is called the Tucker Foundation. And he was just, he was a marvelous human being. And Thomas McCullough was like a surrogate father, became like a surrogate father for me and my wife. But I got a call from, I can't remember whether it was Dean Dye or Thomas McCullough. And I can't remember whether it was a letter or a phone call. Because those were, of course, days when there were no such thing as cell phones. But anyway, they told me, I knew about ABC, about the private school part. Because I was a scholarship student, I worked every semester I was at Dartmouth. And I took whatever jobs they told me to do, I did. So I worked in the kitchen. And then Dean Dye recruited me to work in the private school arm of ABC, travel around to different private schools where ABC minority students were and encourage them. So that was part of my job on campus. So they knew me. And when they decided to have the very first experimental public school program of ABC, they wanted me to be the first resident tutor. Thomas and Elva McCullough would be the resident family. They had a young daughter and a young son. And so I became the first resident tutor. That is, I would live in the ABC house and I would tutor the young men and help recruit tutors from the college campus. And I did that for my sophomore and junior years.
I was just going to ask what years. Okay. And when you did the ABC, you were also a student for the ABC program, correct?
No,
you weren't. So
I did not go through the ABC program.
Oh, okay. Fascinating. Thank you. So then my next question would be, what was the college application process like for you, and how did you learn about Dartmouth?
Well, the college application process was, for me, like all students at Francis Parker, it was a busy, hectic time because you had to fill out the application. You had to fill out the application for loans or scholarships, I should say. And you had to write an essay. And there were no computers when you wrote essays. You had to either handwrite, or if you were really hip, you would type your essay. Mm-hmm. Well, I had planned to go to a college in the Midwest. I can't even remember the name of it now. But my father had begun working with a group of men, and that group included several Dartmouth graduates. And when they found out he had a son at Francis Parker, they said, you need to look at Dartmouth, have him go to Dartmouth. And I had never heard of Dartmouth at all. And my dad said, I want you to apply to Dartmouth. And because I wanted to please my father, I did. But I did it without any intention of actually going to Dartmouth. Yeah, I wanted to go to Grinnell or Carleton, which were in the Midwest. So I applied to Grinnell, Carleton, another Midwest school, and I applied to Dartmouth. And I got into Dartmouth. Well, I still hadn't planned to go. But my friends, all my classmates said, how can you turn down Dartmouth College? I didn't know what a big deal it was, okay? And they made, the friends were very good to me, but they made me feel like I would be an idiot passing up this opportunity. And so I chose Dartmouth.
And when you chose Dartmouth, did you have any idea of what the campus looked like, where it was, what you were getting into?
I knew where it was. I knew that it was all male. That's pretty much all I knew.
And you committed to Dartmouth in 1965, correct?
Correct.
So how did you get to Dartmouth during like your freshman year? Did you drive up? Did you?
By this time, my mother had married Bob Patterson. They married when I was, I think, somewhere between 8 and 10 years old. So we drove from Chicago to Hanover, New Hampshire. And I remember being so excited when we got to the campus. It was about midnight, somewhere between 11 and midnight. I said, I got to walk around. They said, yes. And they think in Chicago, you don't just walk around at midnight in Chicago. But at that time, Hanover had one traffic light. And it was at right where the green was located, right at that intersection. Cask and Gauntlet was on one corner, and then you had the light, one traffic light. I said, Mom, as far as I could tell, they only have one traffic light this whole town. And the streets were all wrapped up. It was pitch black. And I walked around for about an hour. I was so excited. And I came back and went to bed and got up the next morning, and that there it began.
Oh, did you have any expectations as a freshman?
No.
No.
I mean, I had no real reference point.
Yeah.
I had no real reference. I knew it was going to be hard. I knew there weren't going to be any good-looking young women like you there. But that, you know, that for some reason that didn't bother me so much. I'm surprised it didn't bother me, but it didn't bother me that much. And that's it.
And so you had never met anyone who had went to Dartmouth before, right? No Dartmouth alum.
Well, I met Dartmouth alums. The Dartmouth alumni community is very active in recruiting and in the interview process. And so Dartmouth would always have I don't know what they call them. I call it an interview committee. And once your application was accepted, well, once you passed the first stage, the next stage was they would send you a packet of information to the interview committee in your area, and then they would call you to come for an interview. And I remember going into this big downtown Chicago law firm. I mean, just right out of the movies with, leather seats, long, beautiful tables, and walls lined with volumes of case books. It was really something. So I was called down and I was interviewed by about four or five people. And it was very easy. Well, I mean, it was kind of conversational. I'm surprised at how relaxed I felt. And that's probably because I didn't have any expectations. And so I just went in, and I remember one of the men said that his brother had just had twins. I've always been fascinated by twins. And I blurted out, I was so excited. I said, are they monozygotic? And his eyes got that big, because that's the medical term for twins. Mono meaning one, zygote, that come from. Well, I had just that year or the year before taken biology, and Professor Gunta was the biology teacher. And he was, no, Professor Myers. Professor Myers he was German, and his wife was our French teacher, Madame. She was French. And Dr. Myers, he was a character. And I remember a class on the zygote and reproduction, and I remembered the term monozygotic, and I think that one word is what got me in the darkness. They were blown away that I could say, and I knew what it meant. Monos, I use it in the right context, and I wasn't trying to impress them. It just came out. Yeah. I said, "Oh, are they monozygotic?" Which means identical twins, as opposed to fraternal twins. Yeah, I think that one word is what got me in the darkness.
That is so funny to think about. So moving into your time at Dartmouth, what was your major?
Political science. I started out as a Romance language major. I loved languages. And on the SATs for French and for Spanish, I had gotten the equivalent of a perfect score. And English, I'd gotten the equivalent of close to a perfect score. And I could speak and read English and Spanish easily. So I started off in Romance languages, but it's 1965. The Watts riot had occurred. The Harlem riot had occurred, and Romance languages seemed increasingly irrelevant to what was going on in our society. I was wrong, but at the time, that's what I thought. And so I changed my major my sophomore year to political science, and that's the major in which I graduated.
Oh, I was going to ask if you had any other academic interests, but that's where the Romance languages comes into play. Were there any classes or professors that you really enjoyed?
There was a Professor Peter Lewis. Hey, come on in.
Who are you talking to?
So Agnes, this is my sweetheart. Agnes is a student at Dartmouth, and she's interviewing me for that Black Dartmouth student project. Okay. This is the woman I met when I was a senior in college, and
long time ago. Hi, Agnes. If I knew I was going to meet you, I'd have dressed up a little bit. I'll let you go on. Get on.
Okay. Hey, nice to meet you.
You too.
There goes an absolutely wonderful woman.
I love that. You said Professor Peter Lewis?
Yes. He taught some literature classes, and I took one, and it was just fascinating. And I remember reading Things Fall Apart by Chinua Achebe. I was blown away by the book. And in that same class, we read books of like kind of in philosophically that mindset. We read No Exit by Jean-Paul Sartre. And I read it in French, but it wasn't that class. But that's because I could. And I read The Stranger by Albert Camus. I read that in French. But it was that whole intellectual fervor of those writers. Well, Peter Lewis is the one who told me that I should apply for a Rhodes Scholarship. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea what it was. I'd never heard of it. But he was instrumental in getting me to apply.
Wow. Thank you.
And years later,
mm-hmm. No, continue.
Years later, when I was a trial lawyer and I was picking a jury, Peter Lewis was one of the potential jurors. And I looked, I hadn't seen him in at least 8 years. And when I looked at him, and he looked, he couldn't be on the jury because we had this personal relationship.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway.
Oh, that is so fascinating. Oh, it's like a full circle moment. on the topic of studying, do you remember what your favorite place to study was?
Yes, I don't remember the name of it now. It was the library, but it was a special part of the library. I don't know if it was
a
called.
Tower room?
What did you say?
The tower room?
No. It was on the opposite end of, so on this end of the green was Cask and Gauntlet and the Hanover Inn and the student center.
Yeah.
What do they call the student center now?
Oh, it's still the like student accessibility.
Yeah, but they have a name. It was dedicated to someone.
Oh, I do not remember.
Yeah. Well, on the other end of that was the building that I loved to study in. I can't remember the name of it now.
Carson?
No.
We'll find it.
Okay. That's where I would typically go to study.
Okay. So moving on, can you tell me a little bit about your social life at Dartmouth?
Well, my social life at Dartmouth was constrained by the fact that I'm a full-time student and I'm a resident tutor in the ABC program, and another part of my job was to visit young minority students in the private secondary schools in New England. So I traveled a lot. At least one weekend a month, I'm going to visit some Black students in some place. And I'd leave Friday afternoon, get there, spend Friday night, spend all day Saturday on the campus, have Sunday breakfast, and then I'd drive back. So between that, there wasn't a lot of extra time, but I did, was very active in what we then called the Afro-Am Society. I was one of the founders of that. We started the Afro-Am Society, and we would have road trips. This is before the college went co-ed. And we would go on road trips to Mount Holyoke, Smith, and there was another place that was only like 60 miles away. It was all
Wesley?
No, all female school. But it was close to Dartmouth. I mean, it's only like an hour and 15 minutes away, as opposed to Wellesley, Smith, Mount Holyoke. That was a 2.5 hour drive to get to those places. I don't remember. So we would do road trips, but I didn't do a lot of that. I was really caught up in working with the ABC program, and I loved working with the students in the public school program of ABC.
Yeah. You mentioned the Afro-Am, or the Afro-American Society, or the AM. Do you remember what year that was founded?
I want to say it was 1966.
Yeah,
beginning of my sophomore year.
When I look up articles on the AM, they keep referring to it being founded in 1969. So I know it was much earlier, and I wanted to double check.
Yeah. We actually got a building in my junior year, maybe the senior year. And maybe that's what they're talking about. Or maybe that's when they officially incorporated, But we formed in my sophomore year.
Mm-hmm. And it's almost like you're reading my script. So what was the building called?
Well, we just called it the Afro-Am building.
Oh, so where was it on campus?
I don't remember the name of the streets now, but it was, again, if you're on one end of the green where you have Cask and Gauntlet on the other end, mm-hmm. there was a street that went to the right of the library.
Yeah.
So, what was it? It went to the left of the library and up that street about a good long block was the Afro-Am building.
And it wasn't where Cutter is.
No. Is Cutter, remind me, is Cutter one of those brick buildings that was on the far end of the campus? No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't that far.
Okay. Interesting. Thank you. And so we know about Dartmouth and the Greek scene in the Greek culture. Did you ever go out to the fraternities?
Oh, no.
Why is that?
Well, one, we didn't relate to the fraternity culture. Two, a lot of the fraternities were racially segregated. They didn't want Blacks. And we were young, proud Black men. They didn't want us and we didn't want them. The attitudes of both were wrong, but we had our fraternity, so to say, which was Afro-Am. Because there were only, so when I matriculated at Dartmouth, our class had 17 entering Black freshmen, which doubled the size of the Black population at Dartmouth. So there were more Black students in my entering class than in the entire three classes ahead of us. So it was, remember the civil rights movement is really steaming up. And the fraternity culture with, you know, beer and white girls and listening to the Beatles, that was just, even if you wanted to do that, you would never admit it. You see, never admit it. There was one, maybe two Black students, one of whom belonged to SAE, which was considered the premier fraternity on the campus at the time. But he had nothing to do with the Black students, and the Black students had nothing to do with him. I don't remember his name. I really don't know anything about him. I mean, I would see him, but we just wrote him off. He was not relevant to us. And the fraternity scene was not relevant to us.
So you'd say that like you mostly surrounded yourself when it comes to friends to other Black men who are in the Afro American society. And did you also have friends of different like racial or socioeconomic backgrounds?
Sure. Like one of my closest friends at Dartmouth was George Merrill, mm-hmm. who was white. And he was also a resident tutor with me in the Hanover ABC house. And they had a house for guys and a house for women. So we lived in the house for guys. Mm-hmm. And George Merrill and I were great friends through college. I had other white friends. There wasn't a big Hispanic population. There wasn't a big Asian population. It was basically Black and white.
Was it George Merrill? How do you spell his name?
M-E-R-R-I-L-L.
Okay, thank you. And I know you've already talked a little, like you've talked about the Afro-American Society, but are there any other clubs or activities that you were involved in on campus? I mean, other than the ABC and traveling. So those took up a good amount of your time at Dartmouth. That's wonderful. So what role did the AM play to Black students at Dartmouth? What was its role?
It was really the center of our social and political lives. We would host parties and have Black women from other schools come up, or we would travel together to road trips where other Black student groups were having social gatherings. It was as important as fraternities are to its members, the Afro-AM was to us. It was the center of our social life.
Thank you. And what role did you play in the AM, other than its founder?
I was the founder. I may have been the first head, but I was just a member.
There is, I don't know if you remember Blackout, which is a magazine that was published, maybe your junior year in the fall of 1967. And it had a photo of you and also some poems that you wrote. And it has a photo of you and it stated that you were the vice president. And I think you were in this room and you were talking to other students. It's a very powerful photo.
Yeah, I found that magazine. We were cleaning out the garage 2 years ago and we found Blackout. And we stopped what we were doing. And we sat down and we started reading it again. And I said, my goodness, I wrote that. we had a lot of chutzpah, hubris, arrogance, whatever you want to call it. But that magazine was really important to us. I mean, we wanted to say things. And Blackout allowed us to do it. Yeah.
And that's what it was like to put that together.
Oh, well, at that time, the there were three groups in the Black community that were very powerful. One was preachers like Martin Luther King. One was social movement groups like the Black Panthers, the US group led by Ron Karenga, SNCC, and the other group were literary, like they were writers, and poets like James Baldwin, for example. I'm trying to remember. Leroy Jones, who changed his name to Amara Baraku or something like that. And the autobiography of Malcolm X. I mean, writing was a huge thing for us. And poetry, oh man, the books, my goodness. It was a very exhilarating time.
Yeah, and it's also important to note that you did go to Dartmouth in such a dynamic period of social and political like change. And I just, you mentioned some of the books that you read, but what was the art and music scene like? And do you remember some of your favorite songs or books that you read that inspired you?
Oh yeah, I mean, we read so many books in the Black genre, but I was blown away by the autobiography of Malcolm X. I was blown away by Ralph Ellison's The Invisible Man. And Motown had come into its own. And so all of Motown, there was the Motown sound and there was the Philadelphia sound. Holland, Dozier, and Holland. So the music scene was incredible. And there were so many incredible Black artists that came out during that time. And like the Temptations, the Four Tops, the Imperials, and Martha and the Vandellas. I mean, you could just, Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, Stevie Wonder. I mean, on and on. It was the music was intoxicating, and it was all pervasive. It was everywhere.
Thank you. And going back to Blackout, so you wrote a poem titled They Asked Me, which I believe is about the draft for the Vietnam War, or your thoughts on it. And I just wanted to know, were you drafted for the war, and how did drafting affect your, how did just that environment of drafting affect your experience at Dartmouth, and how was the community taking it?
Well, the Vietnam War was a matter of irony for me. So when I was a junior, the draft was instituted, and I was draft age. I mean, I was 20 years old my junior year. Now, at the time, I worked out. That was my other sort of hobby. I worked out all the time. I just loved physical exercise, and it was a balance to all the intellectual exercise. It was a way to blow off steam, because there was so much pressure being a Black man or Black woman at that time. So I would let off steam by running. And I would go to the then football stadium, and I would just run the steps like 10 times, go up, run down, run up, run down, 10 times. And there was, right at the ABC house, a road that went up a long hill. The hill was a mile long. And I would start running that hill. And this is before jogging had become a thing. That was, jogging was sort of inspired by Jim Fix, F-I-X-X, who created, helped foster this subculture of running. And this, he was just coming out, but nobody would say, let's go jogging. That was not a concept. I would just go running because I could blow off steam. And I would go up that hill, a mile up, and then I'd run. They just built a development at the top of that hill, and it went out, the road went out and looped around this new development and came back to the ABC house, and it was a little over 7 miles. And I would do that a couple of times a week, if not three times a week. Mm-hmm. And that's just how, and if I didn't do that, I ran the stadium steps. I just needed to blow off steam, and I loved physical exercise. So junior year comes around, and all of us had to line up, and we were bused to Manchester, New Hampshire, to the draft headquarters, where we would undergo a physical. So I remember the guy in front of me was also a junior. He was white, and he was missing the tops of two fingers, and he had a special boot because one leg was about 3 inches shorter than the other. And he was classified 1A, that is good draft material. I got up, my turn, I was right behind him. And the doctor checked my heart, and he did a double take, and he checked my heart again and said, well, young man, you're not fit for the Army. He thought I had a bad heart because it beat so slowly. Oh. And so medical science hadn't caught up with running, right? So my heart rate was so low because I was so fit, but the doctor didn't know that. So I got a medical exemption. Yes.
Oh, wow.
It's just ironic. Well, by the time I was a senior, the medical science had caught up with the significance of a slow heartbeat. And they knew now that it wasn't a sign of a heart problem. It was a sign of great fitness. By now, and they had just instituted the lottery system. So I was now my first year in
the lottery system.
Yes. So to handle protests that the Army was drafting Black people, young Black men, to fight in Vietnam, it wasn't equitable, they instituted a lottery system. So all the days of the year were given, so it's like every day had a number. So like January 1 was 1, January 2 was 2. And they put they put 365 balls into a rotating drum, and they would pull them out one at a time, and that would determine the order in which the draft occurred. So if your birthday came up number one, let's say your birthday is August 5, then all the young men who were born in 1947 on August 5, they're the first draft group. They're going to Vietnam. And they did that for, and they only went up to how many, the first time the first year they did it, they went all 365 days. When I was in Oxford, my birthday came up at like number 295 or something. And they never got past 150 in the draft. And then they would go through that. And it would take about 5 or 7 years to get back to the starting point. So by the time they got back to the starting point, they stopped the lottery, and I was married, and I was a lawyer, and I was married and had a beginning family. So isn't it ironic? So I was extremely fit, and it disqualified me for military service.
And by the time it was your turn, the lottery system had ended. That is so fascinating.
Yeah.
So did you have any friends that were drafted?
So most of the guys from Dartmouth who wanted to go into military service would volunteer, because being from Dartmouth, they could get in some kind of officer corps. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember any of my friends being drafted.
Okay.
I just don't remember.
Thank you. And one more thing, the ABC House, do you remember where that was located?
I know it was two blocks down the street from the football stadium.
Okay.
I want to say it was on School Street, but I don't remember the name of the street now. It was right on the corner. I know it was right on the corner.
Thank you. So on that point, what did the civil rights movement look like at Dartmouth?
Oh, man. So many different images come to mind. A real commitment to being Black, obviously. In other words, no passing, I think one of the things was James Brown's anthem, "Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud." That was one part of it. Another part of it was the need to be relevant to the needs of the Black community. And another element of it was the need to build strong Black families by Black men marrying Black women and treating them well. That was a big deal. It was really looked down on to have an interracial relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And you had, there was a great push for cultural relevance.
Yeah.
I mean, writers, you needed to write, and you needed to write about Black life. If you're a painter, you needed to paint about Black life. And interestingly, that has been a running debate in the Black community ever since slaves were freed. So, I'm trying to think of, my mind just went blank, but he was a very famous baritone, Black baritone. And my mind just, his name has left me. I can see his face clearly. But he popularized Black spirituals with vernacular. And there was a big section of the Black community who hated that, because Black spirituals didn't have proper English. Been down so long, look like up to me. Or way down Moses, go down Moses, way down to Egypt land. But they were the way we spoke as a people. And so he would sing these spirituals and people loved them. But like the NAACP and a whole segment of the Black community were offended that he would sing these songs in vernacular because it played to the stereotypes that white people had about Blacks.
Mm-hmm.
And he ignored his critics, and he continued to sing. There is a Black woman writer, I apologize to you, that she is absolutely one of the best writers I've ever come across. And her name too has escaped me, but I hope you've heard of her. Wait a minute. I had a couple of her books on Audible. And so I might be able to go through. Yeah, okay. Zora Neale Hurston.
Oh, yeah.
She is fabulous. I don't know if you've ever read her, but you must read. She has a collection of short stories, and they are so representative of people, the same segment of the Black community. Well, I won't say it's the same segment. Zora Neale Hurston wrote about Black people as though white people didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
So she wrote in vernacular, and as Black people talking to Black people, whites don't figure into her. If they do, they're on the periphery. They're just not involved. And people wanted her to write books that educated white people about Black people and condemned the mistreatment of Blacks by whites. And she wrote about Black people. She just wrote about the way we lived. And their eyes were watching God, for example, one of the greatest American novels ever written, in my opinion. But her short stories, to me, are really where she shines. Now, the eyes were watching God, it's just marvelous. But her short stories are nothing short of, well, all of her writing. She's just brilliant. She is just, she's in a league by herself. But the short stories, let me see if I can.
Preacher was.
Trying to remember the name of, I think it's called Every Tongue Got to Confess. Mm-hmm. Every Tongue Got to Confess, collection of short stories. I mean, if you are a modern Black, or if you're a person from another place and you want to know what Black life was like back in the 20s and 30s, you got to read Zora Neale Hurston. But anyway, there was this great cultural upheaval in the Black community to write, to express who we are. And there was one segment is we're going to put white people in their place. And there was another segment like Zora Neale Hurston, we're writing for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And then if we are true to ourselves and writing about ourselves, it'll have universal meaning.
Yeah.
So anyway.
I agree. Huh. And on this topic of civil rights, do you remember the assassination of Martin Luther King?
Oh, yes. It was, school was in session. Mm-hmm. And I can remember, so I'm from Chicago. Chicago has two gang, Black gang empires. The Blackstone Rangers is one, and can't remember the Blackstone Rangers and the Vice Lords. Mm-hmm. And at the top of those games, in the hierarchy, the leaders would probably be on a first name basis with the mayor. I mean, they were criminal enterprises of real sophistication. And when Martin Luther King was shot, the mayor called in the gang leaders and said, please, please help us keep the peace. And the gang members sent out a word throughout the Black community, don't riot, stay home, we're warning you. And so you didn't find what happened in Watts or in Harlem in Chicago. But the impact on the campus was profound. It's like some of us were ambivalent about Martin Luther King. Some of us thought he was way too lenient on white people. Nobody said he was an Uncle Tom. They couldn't say that, but he wasn't like SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, mm-hmm. Or the Black Panthers, which were militaristic and aggressive. They armed themselves against whites. And we were probably leaning more toward that group. But Martin Luther King was deeply loved and respected because he gave his life to the Black community. There's no doubt about that. And so it was a mixture of rage and heartbreak when he was assassinated.
And could you also describe the feelings towards the assassination of Malcolm X?
Of who?
Malcolm X.
Oh, well, for the Black community, that raised an issue of deep ambivalence because most of us thought that it might be wrong to say most of us, many of us thought that the Black Muslims in league with the FBI engineered the assassination of Malcolm X. And I still believe that to be true. It didn't make any sense that these black men would rise up and shoot him and there would be no police around to stop them. And J. Edgar Hoover considered Malcolm X a cancer that had to be eliminated. But that showed the assassination of Malcolm X showed how the divisions in the black community can become violent.
Thank you. And could you describe what activism looked like on campus? Because although you say that there some members of the community did align with the militarism of the Black Panther Party, there wasn't as much militarism at Dartmouth, unlike other campuses like Columbia. Could you describe?
Yeah, well, Columbia was an urban campus and the Black students armed themselves and took over the administration building. None of us felt like that was the way to do it. And here we are stuck up in Hanover, New Hampshire. What are you gonna do? I mean, the Black students, if they needed to, they could meld into the Black surrounding Black community. We can't do that. but I think philosophically, I was opposed to violent upheaval. And generally speaking, the irony of Black upheaval is we tear down our own community. The riots didn't touch any white community. We destroyed our own businesses, our own homes. It's just that it was lunacy. When I grew up in Chicago, when it was racially segregated, the Black community was thriving with businesses because you couldn't go anywhere. So we had our own dry cleaners, butcher, grocery store, dry cleaners, carpenters, painters, you name it. They were all in the Black community. And when integration happened, all those stores eventually dried up because people could go outside the community to shop. But man, I went down to the corner grocery store for Big Mama and it was all Black owned. Walk another block and go downstairs and that's where the cleaners was. You know, and all were Black owned. Mm-hmm. So I kind of missed that part of it.
Yeah. So were you involved in any activism on campus?
There was not, I can't think of a Black person on campus who wasn't involved in activism. It was a way of life. ABC was an activist arm for me. It was the way I expressed my activism, but everybody was active. It wasn't not, I'm too broad by saying everybody, but I'm trying to say it was so pervasive that the issue was who wasn't involved. Everybody was involved in some way, white and black.
Yeah, so what were some of those issues that people were fighting for and what are some of the ways that they were fighting for those issues?
Vietnam War. Big issue, and the white students would get really wrapped up in that, and they would stage sit-ins and sing-ins and rallies on the green. The Black students were concerned about racism and that a disproportionate number of people who were soldiers in Vietnam were Black. And that's why Muhammad Ali's statement in protest to the Vietnam War was so powerful. When he refused to go because as a Black Muslim, he didn't believe in war, but also he famously said, no Viet Cong ever called me nigger. And people were furious, not Black people, but white people were furious that he said that. He said, I'm not going to Vietnam. No Viet Cong has ever called me nigger. And they stripped him of his belt for political speech. For 3 years, he couldn't fight because of political speech. It was terrible. But yeah. Of course, he died as a beloved athletic figure in the world.
Absolutely. And you went into some of the ways that white students were protesting. What were some of the ways that Black students protested?
Well, we would protest by getting involved in actual things. Like there was a project down in Jersey City, which we would go down there and live in a house that the campus, we persuaded the campus to buy a house. If we go down to Jersey City, which is a very poor Black area, and we would tutor the students. So we had to export our activism because there was no Black community around Dartmouth to help. So people were always going down to Roxbury and then going to Jersey City, or they would get involved in the ABC program.
Yeah. Wow. And did you like notice any mixing of like people in activism? Like were there Black students who were advocating with the white students on Vietnam and white students who were advocating? So there was that.
Yeah.
So it wasn't completely segregated in like the social issues.
Yeah.
And also, did the Afro-American Society have any demands to the college?
Oh yeah, we had, we wanted an African-American studies program. We wanted African-American instructors. We wanted African-Americans in the administration. We wanted a heavier recruitment of African-American students. We lobbied and met with the administration numerous times about that.
And how did the administration respond?
First coldness and then eventually warmed up to it.
They
became mildly cooperative.
Mildly, so not fully cooperative.
Well, they would say the things that everybody said. Well, we want Black professors, there just aren't any qualified. We want more students, but there just so few are qualified. And there's some truth to that, because everybody in all the quote Ivy League schools realized they had to diversify their population, and the pool of qualified Blacks was only so large. And to become a professor at Dartmouth is a rigorous road. So they had some justification in what they were saying, but it was a big deal. If you're a Black professor in 69 through 75, and you got a PhD, you gotta have a PhD if you're gonna teach at Dartmouth. How many Blacks choose to move away from an urban center to be in Hanover, New Hampshire? That's a hard place to recruit to. I acknowledge that.
So do you think that Dartmouth was prepared for Black students, the activism and their demands and all that happened in the 60s, do you think that they were prepared?
I don't think any Ivy League school was prepared. Even though, as you know, almost all the Ivy League schools began with reliance on some form of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them, many of them, like Harvard, would fund their grants through slave labor. They owned slaves. I don't know if I can say that about Dartmouth because of where it was located, but Harvard, MIT, they owned slaves or they got money from places that owned slaves. It was a very obvious commercial relationship.
Mm-hmm. And this is a question for myself. Do you think that they, in some form of way, owe Black students or the Black community something for that?
Well,
like reparations.
I personally don't believe in reparations because the people who were harmed and who were entitled to reparations all did. Look at me, I wound up going to a private school and then Dartmouth and then Harvard. How can I should put my hand over my mouth if I say I'm owed reparations. My maternal grandmother, Big Mama, might have been owed reparations, but not me. And I think as long as we as a people fight for entitlement, we won't work. We won't create for ourselves. We won't become self-reliant. We're always looking for somebody else to make our way for us. We must make our own way. Now, you do that in concert with other people. But no, I don't, I'm not, in, my son, my older son, strongly disagrees with me. This is a point of loving contention. But I asked him, why do you think you're entitled to reparations? And then he starts giving me reasons. I said, well, you can't spot any of those reasons. They don't qualify for you. You don't qualify for that. None of those apply to you. I tell him, they apply to Big Mama, but they don't apply to you. And he kind of rolls his eyes. But we as a people were always industrious, self-reliant, and entrepreneurial. That's how we made our biggest strides socially and economically. Waiting for white people to give us something is a sure way to deaden our entrepreneurial spirit, our resilience, and our independence. That's in my opinion.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Here, you mentioned the Dartmouth Foundation project, which went from 1967 to 1969. So could you explain a little bit of what that project was?
Okay, I know it as the Foundation Years Program. Mm-hmm. Again, Dean Dye, a very fertile mind as a social activist who was always looking for ways to help. He was a remarkable human being. He said, well, you guys all went to high school. What about those who are smart like you but didn't have a chance to go to high school? So we had some connections with Chicago, but he had some connections with Chicago. And so they said, if somebody is at the top of a gang, it means that they have leadership and they have smarts. Let's get them to come to Dartmouth and then provide them all the resources they need to make it. And that's how the Foundation Years program started. And it started with three guys, Alan Evans called Tiny, Henry Jordan, and Henry Crumpton called Crump. The first two to arrive were Henry Crumpton, Crump, and
Alan or Michael?
Michael. The reason I pause, because it sounds like the basketball player, but it's not that Michael Jordan. And I remember going to meet them at the Lebanon airport. And we were expecting these, really tough, rock-hewn gang leaders get off the plane. And no, it wasn't Michael Jordan, it was Henry Jordan. And everybody called him Henry, not Hank, Henry. When he got off the plane, he had on a beautiful pair of gray slacks. He looked just like an Ivy Leaguer. Gray slacks, navy blue, sport coat, striped tie, white shirt, button down, beautiful shoes. And Henry Crumpton was the same way. And I mean, they were, I'm trying to remember whether it was Henry Crumpton, maybe it was three, maybe it was Alan Evans, but they were all dressed to the nines. And they just blew us away because this is not what we thought they would look like. And they were all at least four years older than the rest of us.
Do you remember what year you met them?
I want to say it was 1960, It was my beginning of my junior year. 1967, because they started that fall semester with us. Mm-hmm. And I got very close to Crump and Tiny, Alan Evans. And they were really such interesting people. And all of them finished Dartmouth. And all of them went on to have some kind of a career. Mm-hmm. I'm still in touch with Crump, still in touch with Alan. I don't call him Tiny anymore. I call him Alan. And Henry Jordan died about 4 years ago, mm-hmm. 2 to 4 years ago.
Do you remember what gang they were a part of?
No. No.
Okay. Thank you. I was interested in what.
Yeah, it was one of the known gangs, but I just don't remember whether it was the Vice Lords or the other one. I just don't remember.
Mm. So it's good to know that you were able to become like friends with them.
Oh, they were amazing people.
Yeah.
I mean, they were leaders.
Mm-hmm. So you graduated Dartmouth in 1969. Correct. So how would you compare your first day of Dartmouth in 1965 to the last day in 1969?
I entered with hope, excitement, and optimism, and left with anger and alienation. I actually didn't graduate from Dartmouth. I mean, I was a very good student and I had so many credits that I earned my diploma, but I wouldn't walk across the stage. I walked away from the campus and they mailed my diploma to me. By the end of my senior year, I was so angry, filled with so much anger. I didn't see any way for Black people and white people to coexist. And I wrote the Rhodes Scholarship Committee and said, I've decided not to accept my Rhodes Scholarship. And I went home disillusioned and angry. But, and I started working on a street corner in Chicago, 35th and State, which is one of the roughest street corners in Chicago. It's where Stateway Gardens, a public housing project, all Black, began and stretched for at least 2 miles. It was an urban jungle. And the L stop was right at 35th and State. And so when I went home, I worked at my stepdad's service station. He and my mom were divorced, but he was always in our lives. And I worked at his service station just pumping gas. And I would see all this misery walk by. I mean, misery. Gone were the notions of the noble illiterate. They might have been good people. They were definitely good people there, but they were people who were just pressed. They were pressed and oppressed. And we eat our young like sometimes some wild animals. We the victims victimize others who are just like us. And one day, pumping iron, I had a revelation, pumping gas, that God exists and that he's love. And that was a startling thought, that he truly does exist and that he truly is love. And that put me on a spiritual journey, which eventually resulted in me giving my life to Christ when I had been practicing law for 4 years. So for the next 5 years, no, for the next 6 years, I was what you might call a seeker. And then I found that Christ grabbed hold of me and changed my perspective on life. And the anger, he just dealt with the anger and the sense of alienation. And years later, I mean, my mother must have been, I think, 80 years old. And I apologized to her for not graduating because she worked all her life to get me through college. She worked two jobs, even though I earned my own room and board and expenses, she still had to pay part of the tuition. She worked two jobs to do that. And I learned how to cook and be independent because I would cook my own meal and do study by the time I got home. And I never gave her the satisfaction of seeing me come into the Dartmouth camp or seeing me walk across the stage and get a diploma. And I asked her to forgive me. And she said, yeah, that really did hurt my heart. But of course I forgive you. That was just one of the selfish acts that comes from being angry and self-righteous. I thought only of myself and didn't think of my parents.
Wow, very powerful.
And I wrote the Rhodes Scholarship Committee and after I had this revelation and said, hey, if it's available, I'd like to accept the Rhodes Scholarship. They said, well, yeah, it's available. And a month and a half later, I was on the QE2, Queen Elizabeth II, en route to Oxford.
Wow. And you began the application for the Rhodes Scholarship during your senior year?
Yeah.
So, well, after you got your diploma and you were pumping gas back home in Chicago, did you have any idea of where you wanted to go next, post-Dartmouth?
I knew that I needed to get out of the country for a while, get out of all this foment and ferment. And Oxford was the likeliest, the best place to go because they paid all my expenses, right? And I had time to just decompress.
So what was Oxford like and what did you study there?
They have a course that's called Philosophy, Politics, and Economics, PP&E. It's a set course. So that's what I studied for 2 years. And their educational system is quite different from ours. It's as challenging, if not more so, but it's very different. And it was a chrysalis period for me and enabled me to gain more perspective.
What kind of perspective?
Anger produces violence and division and alienation. Forgiveness is necessary. And somehow God is involved in all of that.
And did you always know that you wanted a career in law, or is that something that came after in Oxford?
No. Law had never entered my mind at any point until I had already entered the PhD program in political science at Harvard. And my second month into the program, I woke up one morning with all of a sudden a nascent desire to apply to law school. I never thought about it. It wasn't like in the back of my mind and now had primacy. I never thought about it. But I woke up one morning and I believe that's God planting that desire. And by the time acceptances came out in March, that nascent desire became a flaming desire. Mm. And so I finished my first year of the doctoral program, then dropped it and entered law school in the fall.
And when did you enter Oxford and when did you leave?
I started there in October 1969 and left in May 1971.
And then you entered and left Harvard Law School when?
I entered Harvard Law School in 1972 and graduated in 1975.
And why Harvard?
Well, I really didn't want to go to Harvard. But the John F. Kennedy School was on one side of the parking lot and the law school was on the other side of the parking lot. So, I mean, I'm right there, I'm in Cambridge, why not apply? My first choice was Georgetown because they had a political activist program in law. But I didn't get in. I got into Harvard, so that's why I went.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that your experience at Dartmouth in any way shaped your interest in law, even in the slightest amount?
No. I mean, it must have because all the experiences in our lives tend to funnel us in some direction. So, Dartmouth definitely sharpened my mind. It definitely taught me how to study even more than I had studied in high school, and I studied a lot in high school. And it taught me to think big, but I never thought about law at Dartmouth. Never thought about law at Oxford.
Mm-hmm. And going back a little bit, I know you mentioned that anger and alienation that you felt in your senior year. Is there a particular turning point or event that really, where you really felt that?
Felt what?
The anger and the alienation, or is it just how did things?
It had just been building.
Mm-hmm.
And then my senior year, about a month before the school term ended, I just said, I've had enough, and I just walked away from the campus. I didn't withdraw, I just walked away, never went back. God, when I grew up, Big Mama used to say, God protects fools and little children. Well, I'm an example of at least the former. Notwithstanding the foolishness of my decision, I still got a degree, and I went to Oxford, and I've had a satisfying career.
So you mentioned your career. What was your time like as a magistrate judge?
Oh, I loved it. Best job I ever had. All I had to do every day was ask, okay, what's the right thing to do? That was the key question. I mean, within the confines of the law, what's the right thing to do?
Mm-hmm.
I had an outstanding staff, and I'd been used to working 6 days a week for 25 years. And now as a judge, I actually got weekends. I mean, and I got holidays.
Mm-hmm.
It's astounding. But it was just, I didn't have to worry about keeping clients happy. All I had to do was worry about is doing the right thing. That's a wonderful feeling.
Mm-hmm. So, to build the timeline after you graduated from Harvard with your JD, you then became a lawyer. What is the timeline to you becoming a judge?
So I started practicing law in June of 1975, and I was admitted to the California Bar in early December 1975. And I became a magistrate judge. I was sworn in as a judge like January 4 or 5 of 2004.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And I did that until
2013. So what do you do now?
I'm a private mediator. I kind of do the same things I did as a judge. I just get paid better for it.
And what is a mediator?
So if people are in a lawsuit or about to start a lawsuit, they say, we need to sit down with somebody who's skilled who might bring us to agreement. I'm that person. That person is called a mediator. And that's what I do.
And what types of cases have you overseen in your career?
As a mediator?
Or as a judge, as a lawyer?
Well, as a lawyer, my practice was entirely civil. I did no criminal law. And I handled product liability, negligence, and business cases. As a federal judge, you handle everything. So I had to learn criminal law. So part of my calendar, this is true for every judge in the federal system. You have to handle the criminal and you have to handle the civil. So I had a courtroom deputy. He kept my criminal calendar going, and I had two lawyers working for me to keep my civil side going.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And what is your current impression of Dartmouth today? Has your relationship changed with the college?
Well, I really appreciate what Dartmouth did for me. I've been back only twice, and really both times were more in connection with the ABC program. But Dartmouth was actually very good to me. I mean, I don't have all my feelings about Dartmouth are very positive. It's an absolutely gorgeous campus. It gave me a first-rate education, really challenged my mind and taught me better how to think. And I had outstanding professors who were very impactful in my life. And so when I think back on Dartmouth, all I see are basically beautiful colors. I don't carry any anger, I don't carry any grudge. If people asked, how did I like it? I said, I had a wonderful time.
Yeah. And a question I wanted to ask earlier was, did you have any relationship with Black alums that came before you?
There weren't that many, but Rick Joseph was one who would Rick Joseph graduated probably 5 years before we got there. He's an academic, he's a PhD in, I think, political science, I think. And he is very respected academic, and he would come back to encourage us periodically. He was the first Black Rhodes Scholar from Dartmouth. Yeah. I really can't think of any others.
So on that note, do you have any advice as a Black alumni that you would give to current Black students at Dartmouth today?
Study hard, value the relationships you form there, and appreciate the experience. Don't act too cool and spurn it. Enjoy the experience, it's unique. Study well because it's gonna potentially shape the rest of your career, and value the relationships you form there.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Bill, for taking the time to talk with me on this Dartmouth Black Lives project. I really appreciate it. And I know that generations down the line, Black students are going to listen back and also really appreciate your story.
Well, thank you, Agnes. God bless you and have a, mind if I say a quick prayer for you?
Oh, please do. I can stop recording now and we can do.
Okay, please.